It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
It's Laurie and John. It's always Laurie and John. I've been driven crazy. I'm not driving. I'm driven.
Good morning, Hezzy. You notice that Johnny is the first one to speak?
Yes. I want to point out what I go through in life, dear.
You know, it just crossed my mind. We're doing this all wrong. All wrong.
We are.
And here's what we should be doing. came across my mind.
I'm afraid.
The King's speech at the beginning, when the radio announcer is all dressed up and he sits behind a desk in a padded room, and a young man comes in with a tray and a spritzer and a glass of water and another glass that's empty, and this fellow has done his voice exercises, then he gargles the water, spits into the other glass, and then sprays his throat. We don't prepare like that.
No, I had to go put on clothes because you had me hauling chestnuts all morning since I got out of bed.
You're on
I had
radio.
Made you coffee.
It's true. Five minutes ago,
you're on
Johnny
radio,
was.
You never know. People could see it.
Yeah, well, I know. That's what Lori said. I said, I got to get out of my bathroom, put some clothes on. And she's like, well, nobody's going to see you on the radio.
Listeners, gosh, I wish you could have seen this. There's Johnny standing in his red fuzzy bathrobe that goes down
Christmas
to his
robe.
Ankles.
My Christmas robe.
Big red fuzzy bathrobe. And I have been, I guess 2 years ago, Johnny had the brilliant idea.
Last year,
Johnny had the brilliant idea of buying like 30 pounds of chestnuts.
No, about 10 pounds. But chestnuts is a rarity. You don't find these are fresh chestnuts out of Oregon.
No.
And my goal, Pezzy, was to put them in like little one-pound bags and give them to all of our friends. You know, chestnuts roasting on the open fire, that old thing.
Yeah.
So, and Laurie's like, no, you're not going to sell the chestnuts. And she wound up freezing like, I don't know.
30 pounds of chestnuts. and the problem is now we can't get them out of the show. So I've done all this research online on how to get the dang chestnuts out of the shell. And we have gone through misery here. So this morning we finally realized that if we cut if we cut the chestnut in half, then the shell will peel back, but then the fuzzy stuff stays on the meat. So we're doing plan A, which will then require plan B and C before we get something out of this exercise.
Oh, it's got to be something on Google. You could probably Google the answer.
Oh, we have. And there's all these various ways of doing it. Oh, absolutely. I mean, you steam them, you bake them, over an open fire, over a closed
fire. None of these recipes, by the way, deal with frozen chestnuts that you are now thawed out, boiled, and whatever.
30 pounds of frozen chestnuts. And so Johnny's standing there. I do wish that we had a camera on this. In his long Christmas bathrobe, shelling chestnuts 5 minutes ago. Then he felt he had to get dressed for the radio. Good thinking, honey.
Yeah, that's me. Okay, before Lori tells it, I'll tell it. Yesterday I was doing the same thing for her, and I wasn't paying any attention. I was so caught up taking the shells off of the chestnuts that I put the chestnut meat and the chestnut hulls in the same bowl.
And I've been working already an hour trying to get every little bit of chestnut hair off the chestnuts. And Johnny says, I'll take it over. And I come back, and
there's
the meat
the bowl,
and the shells together in one bowl.
I did create a mess for
it. It was just
Christmas. Gosh, I love Christmas. There's so many good things that happen during Christmas.
Wait a minute. Let me just say, we've now commandeered our grandson, who is currently in the kitchen finishing hauling the chestnuts.
Yeah, but he's young and his fingers
that's
work better.
Grand culinary school.
Yeah.
Well, he's going to do it.
That's what grandchildren are for.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
But no, I mean, one of the houses in our neighborhood already has their Christmas lights on. What happened to the days?
Kidding.
Oh,
no, we're not kidding.
But what happened to the days when Christmas didn't start until Black Friday, which was then known as the Friday after
Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
Not black, but...
Not black in a bad way, but black like from now on we make money between there and the end of the year.
And whatever happened to the fact that there was Thanksgiving, and then on the day after Thanksgiving you started to sell and decorate for Christmas?
It came a lot because of the commercial of Christmas, which grew, I think, in the 50s and 60s.
And now...
Yeah,
I remember the Norelco commercial at Halloween where Santa's on a Norelco head sliding down the snow. Do you remember? That was one of the first ones that ever came out. And that was in October, the end of October. So.
And now, it's Labor Day weekend, they start putting Christmas things in the... I can't understand this.
Okay, let's talk a Christmas
we have
gift.
One season. We have one season for sales.
Plus
every other
sales
little
season.
Thing. But it's sales. It's driven us. So we've lost a lot of our connection to the joy of it. I just hope people do enjoy it. But it's changed a lot from my younger days.
Yeah, I know.
That's the beauty of it. Yeah.
Do you remember
it's
when
great,
you made
great
gifts?
Time.
When you made gifts for people at the holidays?
I do.
Nobody makes anything anymore.
My mother used to. Yeah, I remember when my mother used to even bake cakes, even for weddings. You know,
she
was just a good cook. That's all. You know, that was like a gift, a wedding cake.
Let's talk about the ultimate Christmas gift for people who are looking for vehicles.
No, I'm not getting you one for Christmas.
No, I know you're not.
I wish I could.
Yeah.
Well,
but
if
this
you do,
is a beauty.
It's surprise
this is
both 2020,
this 2020 XT6 Cadillac. My God, I could feel. I could feel the passion in your heart when you wrote this article, John.
Well,
it was unbelievable. I was envious of your love affair.
Exactly
I would have wanted to go out there and get a caddy now too.
That's how it was. And Hezzy, you hit the nail on the head. Johnny came up to me. He looked at me with that look. He put his arms around me. And he held me close and he said, "Honey, do you want to go for a ride in the Cadillac?"
Well, I have to say this. My favorite is the XT5, which is the difference between it and the XT6 is that the 6 has the additional length overall so that you have an extra two seats behind the second row of seating. Ours was called the... What was the whole title of it? Do you remember, honey?
No, I'm not in front of
the
my...
The Cadillac Luxury Premium All-Wheel Drive.
Well, it was the Luxury Premium Platinum All-Wheel Drive.
Platinum, okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, the Platinum is an additional thing beyond the Premium Luxury thing. So it's a Luxury Premium Platinum model. And you don't get any higher than those three words when it comes to vehicles. You know what I mean?
Johnny's point being that he preferred the X5 because it seats four passengers or five, and the XT6 is six passengers, and he doesn't care for that third row, which seats two or possibly three very small human beings.
I can only see two. I think the XT6 is it's touted as a seven passenger SUV.
But the first and second seats are just for two passengers each.
Well, I think, but what they've done is
strapped one on the hood.
the standard model, I believe I'm telling this correctly because I was looking at the add-ons to this, but the standard model actually comes with a bench seat, I think, and you actually have to order it with individual back seats, and there's a space then between them where someone could pass.
Okay.
I loved the XC6, no matter what Johnny says about the 5. I thought that the third row was fabulous for all the many grandchildren that we could take with us that we don't end up also strapping on
the
other
car.
You
could take two. You could put two back there.
Two out of the 12.
Yeah.
stand in line, wait your turn.
Yeah, no kidding. The interesting thing about that, and of course, and I do, I love Cadillacs. Cadillacs tend to think of, in my opinion, tend to think of everything that an American driver would want in a vehicle. So the third row of seats is, honestly, it's difficult to get back to. You need to be young, small, slim, limber to get into those third row seats, really. And I know, I got back there. I sat in the back seat. I got in the third row seats. I wanted to see what it was like.
You should have seen him when he came back in the house.
Huffing
Teddy.
And puffing.
He was, it looked like he had just run an Olympic marathon. I said, where have you been? He said, I was trying to get into the third row of the Cadillac. All bent over in pain.
The thing about...
You know, yeah.
Go ahead, Ez. I'll wait on you.
I was just, you know, based on reading your article, I just thought that it was something very intuitive that you connected with this car about all the gadgetry and all the modernity that they put into the car, which you don't. I haven't heard you say that as much by on other vehicles. So it's just intuitive. Is it more like an American connection as opposed to maybe a European and Oriental connection?
Yes.
What makes it so different?
Well, again, when you evaluate a car, you can look at all the aspects of it and talk about all those things, but you're really only looking at it from your own perspective, I mean, truthfully.
Right.
And what is my car? My car is a Ford Edge. I've had it since 2010. I loved it. I've always loved it. Well, extended a little bit, add all these incredibly wonderful things to it, and you have the Cadillac XT6, I mean, in reality. So first of all, I have a love of this kind of vehicle, this size. It's a big vehicle. My Edge has a V6, and you remember I always complain when they make these big vehicles and they put a four-cylinder in it, and then they try to do it with the turbos, and it got all these things. And you always step down on it, and the four chipmunks in there go, hey, what's he trying to do? And then they decide to do it.
Yeah.
Well, the Cadillac comes with a V6. It's a 310 horsepower, I think. 310 horsepower.
Yeah.
V6, this thing, you know, there's no hesitation.
Goes.
Nine-speed transmission, really, really smooth. Gets up and goes. And what I was saying about the seats, because we were talking about those, but you go to you just pull the lever on the second row of seats, and they just fold right down. The back, the third row seating, you push a button there electronically, and they fold down. And you wind up with, like, I forget, some fantastic, I think it's like 78 square feet of space. I mean, it's huge.
Wow.
If you put all those seats down, you can. It's unbelievable the stuff you could put in that vehicle if you wanted to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even putting the third row of seats down creates more room than is in my Ford Edge. And my Ford Edge has a lot of room I don't even have a third row of seats. So even with the seats up, there's a lot of room.
I want to interrupt. I want to speak to Hezzy's point about the intuitiveness of this car.
Yep.
Johnny, and I kept saying to myself, this has got to be a guy thing. Johnny was all about all of the electronics that this car offered, and he was very seamless with it. He felt, I observed him with the car and talking about the car and his review of the car, and he seemed to be intuitive to the way the controls and the electronics were set up. Not so much me. And
oh, really?
In fact,
okay.
Yeah, and in fact, I was driving in the dark last night. Well, usually it is dark at night.
She's in the dark a lot.
It was a dark and
dark
stormy
and stormy night.
Yeah. And I remember thinking how Johnny was all about how easily he was able to access the radio, change the climate control, and do all these various things that this car offers, everything and then some. But I was not able to do what he could do so easily. However, and this is where this is important, driving this car is intuitive. So even for me, I felt very comfortable. whatever needed to be done in order to get me from point A to point B was readily there, and I never had to think about it. It was intuitive. It was only when I wanted to change a radio channel or figure out the volume control or something like that when I had to kind of think about it. But it really, the car, and again, I've used this in the past, but not lately, I was at one with the car. It really felt that it was listening to what I was trying to make it do. The pickup is phenomenal for a car this big. It's unbelievable. Mm. I mean, it just is so responsive, so quiet. The handling...
Comfortable.
Yes. Oh, very comfortable. But the handling is very interesting because in a large car like this, usually you feel like you are either having to push to handle it or that it's handling you too much. You know, but this was right down the middle. This was... You never had a sense...
A good balance.
Really. Exactly. You never had a sense that the car was manipulating you or that you were manipulating the car. So from that standpoint, I just thought it was, you know, out of 10 stars, it was 11 stars. It was a fabulous thing.
Let me talk about, go back to what you were talking about, intuitive and what I mean by that. And what I mean by that is, and generally when we get a new car, the first thing I do is program my phone into it because I want to be able to talk on the phone if I'm driving, but I don't want to be distracted by holding the phone. So I usually program the phone in. That tells me a lot about how easy it is to use the functions of the car. If it's straightforward, you push the phone button and it says one of the choices is add a phone. You hit add a phone. It says is a Bluetooth on. Your Bluetooth is on. It says look for this. You look for Cadillac, whatever it is, and then you just pair them. So that was simple. All right, so that's the first thing. Then I look at the steering wheel because the steering wheel, there are certain things you want: volume control for the radio. Cruise control. This one, the of course, had a heated steering wheel, and that button was on the steering wheel, obvious to the left of the horn, but an obvious place, easy to find, locate, control. You can keep your eyes on the road and turn the heat on the steering wheel if it's a cold morning. You know, you look. Those are things that make it intuitive. Next, not just the steering wheel, but the 8-inch display screen, which is actually pretty good size. The display screen has all of your controls, and it's a touch screen. If I want to do climate control, I just touch the climate control button. If I want to use the phone, I touch the phone button. Or on the steering wheel, there's a picture of someone speaking. That's a speaker button, and you push that button, and a voice, your radio, by the way, cuts off, and a voice says, "Yes." And I thought that, what would you like to do? None of that. It's just yes. And you say, call home. And it says, just one moment. And then it's going through the list. It doesn't show that, but you know that's what's going on. And it says, calling home. I mean, it was smooth and it was seamless. And it was, and so I wanted to go somewhere.
GPS, Johnny.
Yeah,
GPS.
That's where I was headed. I wanted to go somewhere. And so I'm driving. Normally, when you try to do GPS, if you're driving, it says the vehicle must be stopped for you to use this function, and that, which is good because you don't need to be fiddling around with all that stuff when you're driving. So, but anyway, I'm driving, and I push the button for navigation, and the navigation thing comes up, and at the top it says, say the location, and I just reach over and push that button, and it goes, yes, and I said, whatever it was, 254 something something Road, Sanford, North Carolina. And it goes, just a moment. And then it says, it says something along like, is this the location? And you look at, you glance it out, yep, that's the location. Yes. It goes, starting guidance. And then it goes, your guidance has been started. And so you don't have to really do anything. You just talk to the thing. And I hit the button the other day. And I said, call such and such. And it goes something along the lines of, no number exists. And I said, cancel the phone. And it goes, canceling. And it actually responds to your voice. So now we've got touch. You can touch all these buttons and do all that. And you can actually talk to it. And then by the gear shift, right between the gear shift and the armrest, is a round control, and if you reach down and push that, you can actually move a cursor around. It's not a cursor, but it moves to the various things there, and you can get it that way. So whether you're a person who likes to talk to the vehicle, likes the tactile, the touching of the buttons to make it do what, or
yeah.
you're used to the, you know, the knob, which has been on some of the other ones, you have all these ways to communicate with your vehicle, which makes it easy for you to drive and have the things that you want. Heated seats, air-conditioned seats. There's 18 control ways for the driver's seat. You can set the – once you get in, you get it comfortable to yours. You hit set, you hit one or two, whichever you want.
And then on the dashboard it says you are driver one.
Yeah, you are driver one. And it puts – you get in and you
right.
start the car and it says you're driver one, and it sets the seat to whatever you had in there. Whatever you had programmed into it, which is not unusual.
In your review, though, you said that everything seemed to be on the wheel. So there was a lot of stuff that you could do just from the wheel. You didn't have to go anywhere else. You didn't have to move to your right hand and do that and to the middle of the car. So...
a lot of your basic functions are just right at your fingertips. And so somebody thought about this. That's the thing that I think that makes it intuitive. Somebody actually thought, you know, this is what people need. They need to be able to control, you know, the cruise control and set and do that. And they need to be able to do it easily right here from the steering wheel. They need to be able to control the volume. They need to be able to speak to the thing. And they create it so it's just a simple touch and you're in communication with your
vehicle.
It's so communicative that you kind of want – it's almost like HAL in 2001 Space Odyssey. I almost at one point thought that the car was going to say to me, would you like to stop for breakfast first?
Well, and that's part of this woman's voice. That really is. It's part of the voice. It's like, you know, because when you program GPS normally and you miss a turn. And, you know, my old GPS, it goes – recalculating, like, you pretty obviously made a mistake.
God.
Now I got to work and, you know, just relax till I figure this out. But in this GPS, you know, and in most of the new ones, you don't get any of that. You miss a turn, it just says, drive a quarter of a mile and turn right. It's like, okay, you know, it doesn't communicate with
respectful.
With your vehicle. Yeah, it just, yeah. It's really cool. Mm. It was really, really a cool vehicle.
And Johnny does want one for Christmas.
It also, some of the, no, I don't, but some of the little things, again, these are little things, but you add all of the little things together and you have a lot. So here's a little thing. When you put it in reverse, you get the camera that shows the entire vehicle. There's a picture like from above showing everything that's around the vehicle, and then you have a picture of everything that's behind the vehicle with the lines that show the relationship of the rear of the vehicle to whatever, you know, wherever you're going, and it shows how you're turning.
Yeah.
And you'll remember I talked about this with the Corvette, that I parked the Corvette at one of the shopping centers, and how using that, it was so precise, I could be the exact distance in between both lines. That's the way it is on this Cadillac, too. It's precise. It shows you when your bumper is within, you know, you can literally line the bumper up within probably 2 or 3 inches of to something, if that's what you're trying to do. And it has that feature where you push a button and your rear view mirror becomes the camera that's behind the car. So you have basically 180 degrees of everything that's behind your car, which is a newer feature. We had that on the Blazer, the Chevrolet Blazer, and of course now it's on this it's on this XT6, which is, it takes some getting used to, but it's really an incredible high-definition look at everything that's behind the car through your rearview mirror, which is pretty interesting.
And I did find the pictures that you shared in your review, it really looked like a high-end vehicle. I mean, it was like really stellar. I mean, they've really evolved a great deal more than even a few years ago with Cadillac. They're really pushing the envelope very, very high.
Well, the line,
it's great.
And you can't say these are not European lines. These really are not
European.
It's not a European style. It's a very American-based style, but it's very graceful. That is one of the words that I would use to describe the look of the car or the look of the vehicle.
Yeah.
It's a very, for an SUV, it's a very graceful design, and just it really looks like it would flow down the road, and it actually does, and it sort of floats. I mean, it's got that incredible Cadillac suspension. Dampening. It's all of these, and of course ours is luxury supreme platinum, whatever it is. It's, you can't have any more on a vehicle than is on this one. And it was.
The shifter, it could be automatic. And did I read it correctly? You could also change it so that you could actually do it like a stick shift.
Well, it's no.
You
not
could
like
manually
stick shift.
Manually drive it.
Right. It has paddle shifters. It has paddle shifters,
that's
like
what
on.
You meant.
Yeah, so that when you put it, if you there's a button just to on the left side of the shift, and you have to have your foot on the brake, and then you push that button and pull it into drive. Okay, and then it's in automatic.
Wow.
But if you pull it again, it goes to M for manual. And what I gathered was I didn't try to use the stick shift, but what I gathered was you can use the paddle shifters, which are right at your thumb, on the steering wheel again, and you can control it just like you would any of them that have paddle shifters, up and down, that kind of thing. So now I don't know why you I don't think I'd spend this kind of money. The base model for this vehicle is $52,000, $52,000. Ours was $70,000.
And I would have spent every penny of it.
Yeah. And again, the platinum package, platinum package alone was $5,000. And then it had every bell and conceivable whistle that you could put on it, like we're talking about the sunroof that goes all the way back and opens up, and the two seats instead of the bench seating, and everything was leather.
Yeah.
I mean, just leather front, leather back, leather third row seats. I mean, it just, I don't know how you could ask for more on a vehicle. It's just lovely. It's just a lovely vehicle to drive. Gas mileage, even with the V6 is, you're not going to get 30 miles a gallon. You're not spending this kind of money on a luxury vehicle and then worry about what the gas costs, I mean, quite honestly. But, it gets 20 miles to the gallon average, 24 on the highway, 24 miles a gallon on the highway, and 17 around town. So for a big vehicle, that's good mileage. That's actually good mileage with all the pickup and power and, I'm a big Cadillac fan.
So this is not a vehicle that somebody who lives in garages in New York City is going to buy, because it probably takes up two parking spaces. This is a suburban car. It's not a country off-road car. This is somebody who has a second home, probably, lives in the suburbs and has a second home maybe in Connecticut or Massachusetts if they live in Metro New York, and goes up on weekends. This is for a young family. It's for an older couple like Johnny and me, not that old, but still nonetheless on the, downslope of youth.
Downslope?
yeah, I'm afraid so. We're no longer 20.
I'm already there.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a car, if you're driving 40,000 miles a year, I don't know that you would want this car because you're going to run through it in 5 or 6 or 8 years. But if you are driving, say, anywhere between 12 and 20,000 miles a year, and you're going to see a longevity in this car, and yes, then is worth the money, every bit of it.
Yeah.
And if you take, again, this is a quality instrument. If you take care of it, it will last you forever and ever. With any car, your tune-ups and your maintenance and garage store. And this car is going to become a classic in its own time.
The best used car values used to be, and I'd be willing to bet you it still is, I haven't seen any studies lately, but the best used car values have always been the luxury cars.
Cadillac
Lincoln. Because people don't drive them a whole lot of miles. They really take care of them, and the resale value on them just plummets.
It's great.
So you can buy a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old luxury vehicle. Now, technology changes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one thing when Laurie was talking about that.
Right.
Yeah, you can keep this car forever, but who knows what the technology is going to be in 3 years or something that may want you to get it. You may want to get a new one. But you can get some of these older model, really superior cars for literally pennies on the dollar to what they would have been.
And that wraps up our week.
Oh, my gosh. Is it over already?
Oh, my
God.
It went so quickly.
Well, Johnny's got to get back to the chestnuts.
No.
Oh, I think that Danny finished them during our half-hour show.
Good.
So, anyway, that's us for this week, Hezzy. And we'll talk to you next week. Stay warm.
You, too. All the best. What
all
a pleasure
right.
Thank
you,
Hezzy.
You today.
All right, buddy.
Be well.
Lovely to
have
spend
a great
time
week.
With
Bye.
You every week. Talk
Bye-bye.
To you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. All the best. Bye. Oh, I'm so excited. It never quits. It's always a good week when we hear from Johnny and from Lori. It's just phenomenal. Well, good stuff. Well, we have a moment. Let's quickly do the introduction for Westchester on the Level, and then we'll be able to move on into the next segment. So we'll be right back.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, the biggest thing yesterday, of course, was Sondland in the trials. Evidently, he followed, quote-unquote, orders from Trump on the Ukraine quid pro quo issue. Well, evidently, he turned on the president in his explosive impeachment testimony, and he also implicated Pompeo. So this is the story. The U.S. ambassador to the European Union turned against Donald Trump in an explosive testimony yesterday, telling the House impeachment inquiry that he was following the president's orders when he pressured Ukraine to announce a politically motivated investigation. In a significant development in Democratic efforts to impeach Mr. Trump, Gordon Sondland became the first member of the president's inner circle to acknowledge publicly a, quote, quid pro quo, end quote, over the administration's Ukrainian policy. He also implicated other top officials, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, saying they were, quote, in the loop, end quote, in the Ukraine pressure campaign. Kiev was told to announce the investigation into Hunter Biden, the son of Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden, in order to secure a phone call with Mr. Trump and a White House meeting for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Mr. Sondland alleged. Quote, members of this committee have frequently framed these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? Mr. Sondland told the House Intelligence Committee, which is leading the public phase of the presidential impeachment inquiry. Quote, as I testified previously in private with regard to the requested White House call and White House meeting, the answer is, quote, yes, end quote. Mr. Trump, who has said that there was no quid pro quo with Ukraine, sought to distance himself from Mr. Sondland, a hotelier who was named European Union envoy after fundraising for the U.S. president. Reading from notes outside the White House, Mr. Trump said, quote, I don't know him very well. I have not spoken to him much. He seemed like a nice guy, though, end quote. And Mr. Sondland told the impeachment committee that Mr. Trump had ordered him to work with Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, who was leading the effort to put pressure on Mr. Zelensky to make the investigation announcement. Quote, I followed the direction of the president, end quote, Mr. Sondland said. He added that many top officials, including Mr. Pompeo and then National Security Advisor John Bolton, were aware of the White House campaign. Quote, we kept the leadership of the State Department and the National Security Council informed of our activities, end quote, he said, and, quote, they knew what we were doing and why, End quote. Mr. Zondland testified after witnesses told Congress that the White House, led by Mr. Giuliani and aided by Mr. Zondland, pressured Ukraine to find dirt on Mr. Biden, the former vice president, and the Ukrainian business of his son. And Mr. Trump also wanted Kiev, that's the capital of Ukraine, to look into a widely debunked theory pushed by Russian President Vladimir Putin that Ukraine, not Russia, interfered in the 2016 U.S. election. Well, Mr. Zondland added that he had no desire to set any conditions on the Ukrainians, end quote, and did not agree with the White House decision to withhold military aid to Ukraine. Another witness testified that Mr. Zondland told Mr. Trump that Mr. Zelensky, quote, loved your ass, end quote, and would do anything that he requested. Quote, it sounds like something I would say, Mr. Zondland. That's how President Trump and I communicate. A lot of four-letter words, in this case, three letters, Mr. Zondland said about the call, which he had not disclosed in his private testimony. So, my goodness, stuff is happening. And this might actually be the first time that there might be something to be found that can implicate the president in a certain way. But that becomes really a question if this is a legitimate process, and it just may not be because it undermines what Americans expect. Well, the other big thing, of course, yesterday was in the evening. The Democratic candidates in their fifth presidential debate agree on impeachment and little else, which is amazing. For the fifth round of U.S. Democratic debates on Wednesday, the 10-2020 presidential hopefuls sparred in Atlanta, Georgia over health care, climate change, taxes, and race. The ongoing impeachment proceedings against U.S. President Donald Trump were a backdrop to the debate, at times emerging to the front and center. It's unanimous. Trump should be impeached, was the consensus. The moderator's first question was about the Ukraine scandal and its fallout, which was revealed to be the only issue on which the candidates appeared to agree, that Trump should be ousted. The president broke the law again and again and again, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren said in the event's opening minutes. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders called Trump, quote, the most corrupt president in modern history, end quote, but added, quote, we cannot simply be consumed by Donald Trump, end quote, or the Democratic Party will lose the election. He said Democrats should also focus on other issues, quote, we can walk and chew bubble gum at the same time, he said. Well, former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, at the heart of the Ukraine scandal, added his own angle, quote, Trump doesn't want me to be the Democratic nominee, and Vladimir Putin doesn't want me to be president. Well, Elizabeth Warren still stands alone on her 2% wealth tax. Warren answered a question about how she would unify a divided country by, quote, reintroducing her proposed 2% tax on wealth beyond $50 million with an additional 4% tax on wealth beyond $1 billion. Well, she said, quote, I'm tired of freeloading billionaires, said Warren, adding that the tax would pay for free public college and universal health care while also canceling most student loan debt, end quote. And U.S. Senator Cory Booker was asked whether he agreed with Warren's proposal, leading to the first policy disagreement of the night. Booker said he did not support Warren's wealth tax, but if elected, he would pursue, quote, fair and just taxation, where millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share. Health care reform figured prominently in the four previous Democratic debates. The fifth debate was no exception. Biden continued to push for modifications to Obama-era health care reforms over the Medicare for All proposals from Warren and Sanders. Biden argued that voters are hesitant to make the transformative government-backed changes pushed by candidates, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Biden said he didn't want to force anyone to give up private health insurance. Warren reiterated her longstanding position that she wants to, quote, bring as many people in and get as much help
to the American people as fast as we can, end quote. When questioning came to Sanders, he responded, thank you, I wrote the damn bill, end quote. Well, candidates in this round took a more assertive position on climate change than previous debates. Businessman Tom Steyer has framed his candidacy around the issue, saying during the debate that neither the former vice president nor Elizabeth Warren would characterize climate change as the most critical issue. Biden replied that he does see climate change as such, calling it the number one issue, end quote, facing the country, and, quote, the existential threat to humanity, end quote, eliciting a somewhat stunned look from the billionaire businessman. Well, referencing Steyer, the former vice president went on to say, I don't need a lecture from my friend, end quote, noting his own work on Senate climate change legislation. Bernie Sanders repeated his suggestion that executives in the fossil fuel industry could be persecuted or prosecuted for their actions. The industry has lied and lied and lied, he said. Well, the moderators pressed entrepreneur Andrew Yang, who has never held office, and Pete Buttigieg, whose only political experience is as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, on how their backgrounds have prepared them for the White House, prompting an extended conversation among several candidates about gender, experience, and who has the most broad-based appeal. Buttigieg noted he served in the Navy in Afghanistan, giving him an inside view of how the president's military decisions affect troops, and sought to turn his lack of time in Washington into an advantage. Quote, I know that from the perspective of Washington, what goes on in my city might look small, but frankly, where we live, the infighting on Capitol Hill is what looks small, he said. And U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar was asked about her previous comment that a woman with Buttigieg's experience would not have made it to the debate stage. While she was careful to say she believed Buttigieg is qualified, she reiterated her argument that women are held to a higher standard. Quote, otherwise, we could play a game named, Name Your Favorite Woman President, which we can't do, she said, to applause. And Biden touted his record of passing bipartisan legislation and his long experience in Washington. There's no time for on-the-job training, he said. I spent more time in the Situation Room, more time abroad than anyone up here. Well, perhaps more than in any debate so far, Democrats explicitly acknowledge the importance of Black and other minority voters. Quote, sorry, Biden incorrectly said that he has the support of the only African-American woman ever elected to the Senate. That drew a response from Harris, who interjected by saying that the other one is here. Biden quickly stated, I said the first. Booker added, I've had a lot of experience with Black voters. I've been one since I was 18. Well, maybe Pete Buttigieg is struggling badly with Black voters in southern states. He acknowledged as much, saying he welcomes the challenge of connecting with Black voters in America who don't yet know me, he said. The sixth round of U.S. Democratic debates will take place on the 19th of December, with six more debates set to take place in the first 4 months of 2020. Super Tuesday, on which 15 jurisdictions plus the Democrats abroad hold their primary elections, falls on March 3rd. Typically, Super Tuesday narrows down the hopefuls to the final one or two top candidates. So we'll just have to see where all this ends. 1 second. 1 second. Let me just quickly check this out. I'm not quite sure if this is correct. Yeah, absolutely. New York Mayor de Blasio has ended his 2020 presidential bid that failed to take off. Yesterday, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio ended his campaign for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. De Blasio struggled to gain traction in a sprawling field of Democrats seeking the presidency. He announced his decision on an MSNBC interview on Friday last week, So de Blasio launched his bid in May, but his campaign largely failed to take off. So de Blasio says he feels he's contributed all he can, quote, to this primary election, end quote. He told MSNBC's Morning Joe show, it's clearly not my time. So very, very interesting, but definitely compelling, because I don't know if we discussed that with you before, but just important that it be recognized today. This is interesting as well, because there's trouble evidently in Iran, but we'll see where that leads to. The Iran media reports that the internet access is back after a multi-day shutdown. The internet has been restored in the southern Iranian province of Hormozgan, the semi-official ISNA news agency said today, after a days-long nationwide shutdown meant to help stifle unrest over fuel price hikes. The authorities' blockage of internet access made it difficult for protesters to post videos on social media to generate more support and also to obtain reliable reports on the extent of the unrest. But Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard said on Thursday that calm had returned across the country, state TV actually reported, and the internet connection has been restored in Hormozgan province, and all social media applications are active again, ISNA reported, referring to a province that was a hotbed of protests. Iranian officials had earlier said internet access would be reactivated if calm was restored. The unrest erupted on November 15 after the government announced gasoline price hikes of at least 50%. Protests began in several provincial towns before spreading to some 100 cities and towns across the Islamic Republic, and they quickly turned political, with protesters demanding top officials to step down. Well, Amnesty International said it had documented at least 106 deaths of protesters killed by security forces, which would make it the worst street unrest in Iran in at least a decade, and possibly since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Well, Iranian authorities said that several people, including members of the security forces and policemen, were killed in street violence, which Tehran blamed on foreign foes. That's a typical, you know, sort of standard that we hear from them. So this is like the same old thing. Well, we got some other issues, of course, with regard to Prince Andrew of the United Kingdom. The Playboy ex-pilot has been dogged by a scandal, and Prince Andrew is often referred to as Queen Elizabeth II's favorite son. But his image as a Playboy former war hero has been repeatedly hit by scandal. In 1982, just 22 years old, he was hailed for piloting the Royal Navy helicopters during Britain's last colonial war in the Falkland Islands after Argentina troops invaded. That now stands starkly at odds with Andrew's public defense of his friendship with U.S. sex offender Jeffrey Epstein in a lengthy television interview broadcast last weekend. Well, the interview in which he denied having sex with a 17-year-old girl allegedly trafficked by the disgraced financier has been seen as a public relations disaster. Sorry. Excuse me. Andrew, who is eighth in line to the throne, was criticized for arrogance and lacking compassion for Epstein's victims, prompting businesses and charities to distance themselves from his projects. On Wednesday, he was forced into a humiliating withdrawal from public engagements to avoid further damaging the royal brand and those associated with it. Born Prince Andrew Albert Christian Edward on February 19th of 1960 at Buckingham Palace, he was the third child of the Queen and Prince Philip, and the first to be born to a reigning monarch since Queen Victoria's daughter Beatrice back in 1857. His elder brother is heir to the throne. It's Charles, Prince of Wales. The other brother, Edward, Earl of Wessex, is 4 years his junior. As a young man, Andrew was seen as one of the world's most eligible bachelors and was linked to a string of women before he married Sarah Ferguson in 1986. Sorry. The couple, who took the title of Duke and Duchess of York, had two daughters, Beatrice, born in 1988, and Eugene, who arrived 2 years later, but the marriage broke down. After their separation in 1992, Fergie was photographed topless next to a swimming pool in the south of France, cavorting with a U.S. businessman. The couple formally divorced in 1996, but have remained on good terms with frequent speculation they could even remarry. The Duchess reportedly still lives in the same Windsor home as her ex-husband. Following their split, Andrew has been snapped sunbathing with topless women in Thailand and even at a so-called hookers and pimps party with the New York socialite Ghislaine Maxwell. Maxwell, whose father was the media tycoon Robert Maxwell, has been accused of procuring underage girls for Epstein. She has always denied the claims. And Andrew left the Navy in 2001 and became a special government trade envoy, earning a new nickname, Air Miles Andy, as he jetted around the world at taxpayers' expense. Questions were also asked about his judgment after he was linked to the son-in-law of Tunisia's deposed ex-president Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi's son Saif, and a Kazakh billionaire. He has also faced repeated claims of being brash, arrogant, and rude. But his links to Epstein, who was found guilty in 2008 of paying young girls for massages, but served just 13 months in jail under a secret plea deal, threatens to eclipse that. Epstein was found dead in a New York jail in August after being arrested on federal sex trafficking charges. And the Epstein scandal resurfaced in 2011 when a photo emerged of the prince with his arm around Virginia Roberts, who was 17 at the time and has since claimed she was forced to have sex with him. Andrew has repeatedly denied this and suggested the photo could have been doctored. Another photo showed him walking with Epstein in New York Central Park on December 2010, a year after he left prison. The prince said in Saturday's interview he had, quote, let the side down, end quote, by continuing his friendship and with Epstein, but said he was trying to act in an honorable way. He refused to denounce Epstein completely, saying his home in New York had been a convenient place to stay and describing the financier's behavior as unbecoming. Corrected by the interviewer that Epstein was a convicted sex offender, the royal said he was trying to be polite. Since then, it has been open session, or actually open season, as the media has dredged up his past and newly found indiscretions, including claims he used racist language on more than one occasion. So he's definitely under assault, but that is his history, or so it's alleged, and then it just is what it is, and there's not much you can do about it at this particular juncture, that's for sure. one second. This is very interesting. Evidently, a French court has sentenced the sister of Islamic State group propagandist to 9 years in prison. A French court yesterday sentenced Anne Diana Klein, whose brother was a notorious propagandist for the Islamic State group, for 9 years in prison for terrorist association. Paris's criminal courts handed down the sentence to Klein or Klein, C-L-A-I-N, I don't know how to pronounce it, 44, for having attempted between 2015 and 2016 to head to conflict-ravaged Syria with her husband and four children to join her brothers Fabian and Jean-Michel Klein. Well, Fabian Klein has been identified as the voice in an audio recording claiming responsibility for the 2015 Paris attacks, which killed 130 people, and warning that they were just the beginning of the storm, end quote. His brother has also been accused of being an Islamic State group propagandist in Syria. The court also found Klein's husband, Mohamed Amri, a 58-year-old Tunisian, guilty and handed him a 10-year sentence, as presiding judge Isabelle Prévost-Desprez highlighted the couple's determination to reach Syria. that project failed, but not because they wanted it to. You never gave up on the idea of your own volition, she said, recalling how Anne Klein's attempt to reach Syria failed when the convert to Islam was arrested at the Turkish border on July 16, 2016. You took your children off on a deadly trip as far as your arrest in Turkey on the Syrian border, said Prévost de Pré, saying the scheme was extremely serious, end quote. And Amri had claimed the couple had not been planning to stay in Syria, but merely to visit family. The couple's entourage, including their children, burst into tears when sentencing was passed down. The prosecution had called for 10-year jail terms for both. And Klein told France on August 2015 with Amri, their three children and his son from a previous relationship, all four of them minors. She said in testimony she had hoped to experience an Islamic utopia, quote unquote, but admitted she had been blind to the ideology of her radicalized brothers and that of the Islamic State group. Klein's lawyers said she had renounced those beliefs over the past 3 years and added she would appeal. Oh, God. Oh, what can I tell you? So let's just go back. There are some other things that are happening, which might be very interesting for you to hear about. On the international stage, it seems there's they're actually global aircraft rivals. Europe's Airbus and U.S. manufacturer Boeing have secured tens of billions of dollars worth of deals at the biennial Dubai Air Show, which ended today. There are five main standouts from the 2019 event. Evidently, Emirates, the Middle East's largest carrier, made massive cutbacks to its initial commitments with the industry's two biggest names. The Dubai-based airline signed a $16 billion deal on Monday for 50 Airbus A350-900 wide-body aircraft, replacing a larger commitment signed earlier as part of its decision to stop buying the A380 Super Jumbo after struggling to fit its capacity of 500 to 850 passengers. With Boeing, Emirates on Wednesday signed a firm order for 30 787 Dreamliners worth $8.8 billion at list price, 10 aircraft fewer than the commitment it made 2 years ago. The airline, facing slowing economies in the Gulf, also trimmed a mammoth contract for 156 Boeing 777X aircraft it signed 6 years ago to 126 amid delays in delivering the new long-range model. Emirates, the largest customer for the Airbus A380 and Boeing 777, has shaved at least $26 billion from its commitment so far this year. Airbus has capitalized on Boeing's woes with its 737 MAX, bagging two major deals with Emirates and Air Arabia worth $30 billion in addition to several smaller deals. As well as the Emirates $16 billion order, the United Arab Emirate low-cost carrier Air Arabia placed an order for 120 Airbus A320s and A321s worth $14 billion. Saudi Arabia's privately owned low-cost carrier Flynas, FLYNAS, European budget airline EasyJet, and Air Senegal also made agreements with Airbus. Flynas ordered 10 A321s. EasyJet ordered 12 Airbus A320neo narrow-body jetliners, and Air Senegal signed a memorandum of understanding to buy 8 of the new A220s. General Electric said its leasing arm, GECAS, has signed an order for 12 medium to long-range Airbus A330neo aircraft and 20 A321 XLRs. Well, Boeing 737 MAX did get a boost this week after fresh orders for the plane had been grounded since March after two crashes. The aviation giant said on Tuesday it obtained a firm order with an unnamed airline for 20 of the 737 MAX models for $2.3 billion. The announcement follows an order for 10 MAX planes from Turkey's Sun Express, announced on Monday, and a letter of intent on Tuesday from Kazakhstan's Air Astana for 30 aircraft. And despite these, orders for Airbus's small-sized family of A320s have overtaken those of the Boeing 737 for the first time. A320 orders have hit 15,400 against under 15,200 for the 737. 737 orders are in addition to Boeing's Dreamliner deal with Emirates. Well, Abu Dhabi's national carrier Etihad, one of the region's three major carriers, along with Emirates and Qatar Airways, refrained from placing any new orders at the show. Etihad had posted a total of $4.67 billion in losses for the past 3 years and is expected to continue making a loss for at least three more years. Earlier this year, the airline scrapped deals from Boeing and Airbus worth over $20 billion. The two main aircraft carriers forecast that Middle East countries will invest some $1.5 trillion in commercial aviation over the next 20 years. Boeing and Airbus officials said $725 billion would go on the purchase of around 3,200 aircraft and another $790 billion in aviation services. Air traffic in the Middle East is forecast to grow by between 5.1% and 5.6% a year until 2038, the manufacturer had advised. So, very interesting news, and we'll see where it all leads. So, it's going to be very, very interesting to see how it all happens. One second. Now, let's just quickly look to see what is happening a little bit closer to home, but we're actually here in, we're going to go to Bolivia. Bolivia's interim government proposes an election bill as deadly unrest continues. It seems that Bolivia's interim government presented a bill yesterday that aims to forge a path to new elections and defuse street violence that has racked the country and killed 32 people since a disputed October vote. Now, the South American country's two chambers of Congress are expected to debate the election bill beginning on Thursday, that's today, and possibly extending into Friday, which would annul the October 20 poll or election and appoint a new electoral board within 15 days of its passage, paving the way for a new vote after long-term leftist leader Evo Morales resigned under pressure this month. A date for a new election or new elections was not included in the proposal. The bill called for a credible and professional election body, quote, in order to pacify the country and redirect democratic institutionality, end quote. It's currently led by a caretaker government. Bolivia is grappling to mend stark divisions between Morales' supporters and opponents seeking to move beyond his nearly 14-year rule. Morales stepped down on November 10 under pressure from protesters, civil groups, security forces, and allies, as well as an international audit that found serious irregularities in the election court count and cast doubt on his announced outright victory. And since then, an interim government under conservative former Senator Jeanine Añez has struggled to quell deadly violence and fanned some divisions with abrupt shifts in policy away from Morales, the country's first indigenous president. In a statement earlier on Wednesday, Añez said she would present a bill calling for new elections, quote, as the whole country is demanding, end quote, and that it would be through legal constitutional channels unless lawmakers blocked it. Well, we have developed a basic bill. It can probably be corrected, agreed upon, enriched by all the sectors that are involved with the aim of pacifying the country and choosing our rulers, she said. But there will be elections in the country, we guarantee it. Conflict in the region of Cochabamba and the high-altitude city of El Alto has rattled Bolivia over the last week since Morales' departure, with clashes at a gas power plant blockade on Tuesday that left 8 people dead. The Ministry of Defense, in a statement on Wednesday, said its supporters that supporters of Morales' MAS party were surrounding the plant with the intention of damaging it with explosives. The ministry said the armed forces would safeguard the plant from any attack or takeover attempt. Now, the total number of deaths in the post-election unrest rose to 32. According to Bolivia's official human rights ombudsman, most of those in the last 10 days, sparking calls for investigation into human rights abuses. On Wednesday, hundreds of people lined up to refill gas canisters in La Paz, while lines of cars snaked through the city's roads, waiting to refuel after protests by Morales' supporters choked off fuel and food supplies in recent days. In a news conference on Wednesday, Government Minister Arturo Murillo claimed that Morales was continuing to stoke unrest. He showed reporters a video of a phone call, including audio, allegedly of Morales directing plans for blockades. Reuters was not able to verify the contents of the video. Quote, it said, "This is Evo Morales doing state terrorism," Murillo said, without naming the source of the three-minute video. Quote, "In the next few hours, we will file an international lawsuit on this," he said. Morales at a news conference in Mexico, where he was granted political asylum when he fled Bolivia, in turn accused the interim government of using excessive force against peaceful protesters. The military has said protesters have used explosive guns and homemade bazookas in clashes. Quote, "They are using bullets against people peacefully mobilizing in defense of democracy," said Morales, who has talked about returning to Bolivia to finish his term until January 22. "It makes us remember times of military dictatorship," he said. Well, that's definitely the case, that's for sure. Let me just quickly look, because there were some other things that I needed to get to you about. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this was it. Evidently, the United States Congress has passed bills linking Hong Kong trade status to human rights. The United States House of Representatives has passed legislation to back protesters in Hong Kong and send a warning to China about human rights, sending two bills to the White House, where President Donald Trump is expected to sign them into law. Mass protests for more democracy and autonomy have roiled Hong Kong for more than 5 months, with escalating violence and fears that China will ratchet up its response to stop the civil disobedience. Well, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which the Senate passed unanimously on Tuesday, would put the former British colony's special treatment by the United States under tighter scrutiny, linked to Hong Kong's autonomy from Beijing. A second bill, which the Senate also approved unanimously on Tuesday, would ban the export of certain crowd control munitions to Hong Kong authorities. So the two bills have been sent to the White House, where U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to sign them into law. And once that happens, the State Department would be required to certify at least once a year that Hong Kong retains enough autonomy to qualify for the special U.S. trading consideration that helped it become a world financial center. Officials responsible for human rights violations in Hong Kong could also be sanctioned under the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. While many see the act as symbolic, it could alter the nature of relations between the United States and Hong Kong. Beijing promised Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy for 50 years when it regained sovereignty over the city in 1997. But protesters say freedoms have been steadily eroded. U.S. policy toward Hong Kong has been underpinned by a 1992 law called the United States Hong Kong Policy Act, which sends the territory, or affords the territory, special status as separate from China in trade, transports, and other areas. Under the 1992 law, the president can issue an executive order suspending elements of Hong Kong's special status if the president determines that the territory is, quote, not sufficiently autonomous, end quote, from Beijing. The Human Rights and Democracy Act would amend that law, putting Hong Kong's autonomous state under close scrutiny. The other bill would ban the exports to Hong Kong of items such as tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets, and stun guns. The passage of the two bills by the Senate and House has angered Beijing, which denounced the legislation as gross interference and violation of international law. If they become law, tension between Washington and Beijing is likely to increase, casting a shadow over negotiations to end their trade war. So the trade between Hong Kong and the United States was estimated to be worth $67.3 billion in 2018, with the United States running a $33.8 billion surplus, its biggest with any country or territory, according to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. The American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong has said that anything that changes the status of Hong Kong, quote, would have a chilling effect not only on U.S. business and investment in Hong Kong, but would send negative signals internationally about Hong Kong's trusted position in the world economy. So, my goodness, so much that is definitely compelling. Let me quickly go back to our studio screen. Let me just play for you what's going on. It's Cabot Creamery, and we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sort of. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge.
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show.
Cabot Rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
One of those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat.
Check.
Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. Evidently, the leader of the opposition Blue and White Party, Benny Gantz in Israel, announced that he has been unable to form a coalition government by a Wednesday midnight deadline, which is it's 7 hours later in Israel than it is here. It's now 11:11. That means it's 11, so that's 7 hours. So that's 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. and 11 minutes, or 6:11 p.m. in Israel right now, and it's Thursday. So the blue and white leader said in a statement that he had informed President Reuven Rivlin that he was unable to form a coalition. Under Israeli law, Parliament now has a 21-day period where any lawmaker can try to cobble together a 61-seat majority and become prime minister, leaving the door open for dark horse candidates. Well, Gantz and Netanyahu will likely continue their efforts to reach out to smaller parties and to explore the possibility of a unity government. Gantz said he would work over the next 3 weeks to form a good government for the citizens of Israel. Earlier in the day, right-wing kingmaker Avigdor Lieberman refused to endorse a candidate for prime minister, virtually guaranteeing the country would be forced into a new election. Well, initial elections in April were inconclusive, and in a September rerun of the vote left both Netanyahu and Gantz short of securing the required parliamentary majority to form a government, with Lieberman holding the decisive vote. But after weeks of negotiations, Lieberman said he would not endorse either side. And Lieberman had called for a national unity government between Netanyahu's Likud party and Gantz's blue and white, but he has reiterated his opposition to a Likud government, a Likud-led government that would include ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties with religious influence over life in Israel. He's also opposed to an administration headed by blue and white that would be dependent on support from Arab parties that he described as a fifth column, quote unquote. Netanyahu on Wednesday issued a last-minute appeal for compromise, telling right-wing factions that Israel was becoming a joke, quote unquote, due to its political deadlock. A third election in a year would be institutional insanity, he said. Netanyahu, in office for the past decade, failed to cobble together a government coalition after the inconclusive September election. And President Rivlin then asked Gantz with doing so within 28 days, but his deadline was set to expire at 11:59 p.m. local time on Wednesday, which at that time would have been actually 6:59 in the morning here Thursday morning it was 11:59 p.m. their time, meant that it was 7 hours earlier our time here. So that was at 5 o'clock p.m. our time is when this thing transpired. Well, let's just quickly see what else is on the dock, so to speak. And let me just see if anything else has transpired. And this is going to be very interesting because it's a perspective. This is a report from France 24 with a guy by the name of Reza Dehati. He is of Iranian descent. And listen to this report. It's about 8 minutes long. I think you'll be able to enjoy it.
It's time now for perspective. This year, the world marks the 40th anniversary of Iran's 1979 revolution, a series of events that saw the removal of the US-backed Shah and the arrival of an Islamic Republic. My guest today is celebrated Franco-Iranian photojournalist and humanitarian activist Reza. His photographs from that time gave the outside world a window onto the revolution and what he's described as the broken promises of its aftermath. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us here on France 24. Now, we will get to your book very shortly, but first I'd like to talk about what's currently happening in Iran. Some saying that the popular unrest we've seen in recent days is similar to 1979. What do you make of it all?
Well, what's happening now today, it's absolutely terrible for the Iranian people because it has been a cut off of the internet for more than 6 days now. And it remained me the days that have happened to the revolution. I mean, what's happening in Iran now, it's a really pre-revolution attitude in the people and the government, they know about it. It is not about the oil or price of the gas or going. It's because people, they have enough of this government, of the mafiosi government, of the criminal that holding this whole people and the whole world and Middle East hostage for them. What's happening in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen, even all around the Iran, it's showing that this is the end of this empire. But the Iranian people living really in a dark, dark situation, actually.
And do you think those levels of anger, of frustration, are comparable to the levels of anger and frustration in 1979?
I think it's much more now, what I see here, because what was happened in the past 40 years has created a nation of total frustration. And this frustration over 40 years that lost everything. People have nothing now left for them. While they see all these Ayatollahs and their families living in a lavish lives and the corruption of the billions of dollars, and people on this, more than the 10 million Iranians living under the level of the poverty, while the government and the Ayatollahs, they have the billions of dollars. So that's why what's happening now in Iran, it's really, this is the real revolution.
And there is a huge information blackout at the moment in Iran, as you just mentioned. Are you in touch with anyone in the country at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm always in touch with the people or getting information through other friends which they are in touch. And what the government doing now, it's just inhuman. They don't even give many of the bodies of the people that there have been more than 200 people died, and they don't give the bodies to the family. Or they ask them about 40 million tuman, which is a lot of money, and they have to just bury at the night times because they don't want to day bury it. It's a really criminal situation against Iranian people now.
And do you think there's enough anger that we may be seeing a regime change, a revolution again in the coming months, years? Is that something you feel is a possibility?
Definitely.
Okay, so we can go on now to your book. Along with your brother, you've released your latest book of photographs entitled Iran, Rêve et Dérive. In English, I think that is translated as something along the lines of dreams and broken promises, maybe.
Definitely.
It's a selection of your photographs from that time. Why did you want to publish this book? What did you want to achieve with it?
What happened in the Middle East and Iran in the past 40 years, it was because of arriving of the Khomeini and Islamic Republic of Iran. What's happened in the after Iran, which is Al-Qaeda, which is Daesh, which is all these things happening in this old region from Afghanistan to all Middle East, it's because of the Iran Islamic Republic, which is not even a republic. It is the first Islamic state in the world. What those mullahs has done to Iran, it's 100 times worse even than what the Daesh doing now. I have been in Iraqi Kurdistan past 5 years, and I have seen what the Daesh doing. And I always remember, well, the Iranian mullahs doing this for 40 years in Iran, and nobody pointing them out. So that's the reason we thought that it's very important in this historical moment, 40 years after, to let the people know what is meaning to having religion people in the power. What is meaning to let those religious people to get the power and grab the power and stay in the power? We saw the situation in Iraq, in Lebanon, the people which they are demonstrating now in all the streets of those countries around Iran, they are all chanting against mullahs, against Iran Islamic Republic intervention in their countries too. So that's why we believe, I believe, that it's a real start, the beginning of the end of not only Islamic Republic, but all kind of the government that use religion to stay in the power.
And going back to 1979, what were your hopes for the revolution? You were imprisoned, tortured under the Shah. What did you hope the revolution would achieve?
Freedom. This is the main things that all humans need. Doesn't matter. It is not the food. It is not the comfort. The freedom is the essence that every human needs. We are really, that's the bottom line of everything. And we were hoping for a freedom. We were hoping for freedom of speech. We were hoping that we will get a better and more just distribution of the wealth in Iran. And that's why everybody was on the street. That's why we also see how France protected Khomeini and brought in Iran. And we said, okay, if all these countries, they think that Khomeini will be good for Iran. And the other thing was that the Khomeini was totally a liar. He was sitting here in Paris and sending messages that I will bring freedom to Iran, that the water, electricity, oil, gas, everything will be free for the Iranian. They will not have to buy houses. I will give the house to everybody. And this is all the lie and the lie and lie.
And what, if you had one, what would be your message to the Iranian youth of today? Your revolution did not work out as you wanted it to do. Would you encourage young people in Iran today to follow a similar course of action?
I think that there is no way of going back. Yes, we know that we may go again in trouble. That may happen, but we will be better off if we can get rid of all these religious people that hang in the government. Because Iran has the history of the thousands of the years of all kind of the government and the culture. It's a very, very rich cultural country, the people. So this is the end of what we have seen over past 100 years, few hundred years of mullahs, of Islamics, of the Shia group being in the power. And I think that whatever happened, we will get rid of the religious people in any way.
Reza, photojournalist, activist, thank you so much for coming on to speak to us here at France 24.
Thank you for having me here.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.
Well, very, very exciting to say the least. Okay, so let's quickly look to see if anything else has transpired. And, you know, I'll just look to see if there's anything that's come on board. One second. Let me just see. All right. Bear with me. I'm going to just try to see if any other news stories that becomes evident. One more second here. Okay, let me just see. Yeah, this is just to give you an update on what's been happening in Lebanon. Evidently, it's our right to arrest us. It's your right to arrest us, is what Beirut protesters say, but they're going to keep up the pressure. So evidently, Lebanese protesters vowed yesterday to keep pushing for an overhaul of the country's politics. A day after violence rocked Beirut as riot police clashed with demonstrators who prevented lawmakers from reaching parliament. So Tuesday began and ended with violence in downtown Beirut as anti-government protesters blocked off parliament to prevent ministers of parliament from holding a controversial meeting. And riot police beat protesters with batons and threw several to the ground in repeated clashes throughout the morning. So that's the tragedy over there. Let's just see if anything else has transpired that we haven't yet covered. More clashes in eastern Mali, killing a Malian soldier and jihadists. It's amazing. The whole idea of jihad is all over the place and just spreading to Africa, to South America, to Asia. It is absolutely mind-boggling. It's like a fever. But you would think that as the incursion of this Islamic world that wants to impose itself evidently would be recognized for what it's done in Iran and in Lebanon and Yemen and in in Africa and places like Mali and Niger. And, you know, you would think that it would be understood, but evidently it's not. So bear with me a moment as we move on to some other things. One second. No, I think we're fine. We're fine over here. So that's where we are. And what I'm going to do is just tomorrow is Friday, as you well know. You don't need me to tell you that. But tomorrow we're going to be speaking with the mayor of the village of Ossining, Victoria Garrity, and we'll be talking to her in the first half hour. So I can't wait to speak to her. There's always something compelling about her perspective and issues. So that's really very nice. Okay, so let me go back to our studio screen and then end up going to our site. Bear with me here. Okay, I guess that's about it. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. And if we don't, just have a great weekend. And I guess that's about it. So all the best and goodbye.